Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Kirk Ellis. He's a writer and producer. He wrote and produced the John Adams series on HBO, as well as many other film and TV projects. He's the chairman of the Santa Fe Arts Commission, and we are here today, the 4th of July, to talk about the Declaration of Independence. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. And I should tell your listeners that they can simultaneously be enjoying the annual John Adams Marathon on HBO, which I think began at 6 o'clock this morning, is running for the next 9 hours.
Good heavens. Well, if you don't go to Pancakes on the Plaza, or if you can't get out of the house for whatever reason, turn on your HBO. So we are going to read the Declaration of Independence aloud, but before we, and comment on it, because you have a great deal of historical knowledge to bring to this, but before we do that, let's set up for a moment the conditions that gave rise to there being a Declaration of Independence in the first place. What was happening in the colonies? What did both the British government and the colonial governments look like at that time?
Context is obviously important when you're dealing with any of our founding documents, and this is one of the two great ones, along with the Constitution. And we need to sort of put people's minds in the time in which the Declaration was composed by Thomas Jefferson. This is the summer of 1776. The Battle of Lexington and Concord is a year old, and Bunker Hill has taken place. Basically, Boston is an occupied city. And we have to remember that at this time, what we consider the Revolutionary War, which hasn't yet broken out in full, is really confined to New England. And it is the New England Patriots.
It's already underway.
Well, the Revolution is one of those undeclared wars in this sense. It becomes an issue after the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence is that document from which there is no turning back. And the Revolution has begun as an issue of representation in the British Parliament. Now, America is not alone among British colonies or among British districts. There are other districts like Sheffield, for instance, that do not have representation in the British Parliament. But It is a combination of onerous taxation, a monopoly system that's been created by the British Crown, and the fact that you have royal governors who are simply dissolving the local legislatures. This happens in Boston, this happens in Virginia, which become the two sort of flashpoints for revolutionary sentiment. And it's because of this and the increasingly onerous conditions in Boston that the Continental Congress meets throughout 1775 and 1776. And for most of that time, the Congress is looking not to declare independence, but to find some accommodation with Great Britain. John Dickinson, one of the delegates from Pennsylvania with Benjamin Franklin, urges that there be what's called an olive branch petition that is sent to the king late in 1775. That is finally answered by the king with even greater oppression, more troops being sent, a complete lack of accommodation. At this point, the New England delegates start pushing harder and harder for a Declaration of Independence. This causes great consternation in the Continental Congress. Richard Henry Lee from Virginia proposes a motion in June, around June the 10th, essentially saying that these united colonies are, and of a right, ought to be independent states. The debate is so contentious that Congress is actually adjourned until July the 1st of 1776. In that time, a committee is formed to consider a Declaration of Independence should the vote in July tend in that direction. A number of people are on this committee, including John Adams. And according to Adams's autobiography and the notes he took at the time, it was Adams who actually came to Thomas Jefferson and asked him to write the Declaration. He essentially recruited Jefferson for this. And Jefferson asked, with good reason, why do you want me to do this? And Adams said, reasons enough. What can be your reasons? And Adams said, well, firstly, you're a Virginian, and a Virginian ought to appear at the head of this business. Remember, Virginia was the most populous and the most powerful state, and the Revolution, the Declaration, could not be seen as something that came strictly out of one province or another. It needed to be seen as something that came out of a unified Congress. Reason second, I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. You are very much otherwise. And then he gave the third and, I think, best reason for Jefferson to write it. He said, you can write 10 times better than I can. And with that, Jefferson holed himself up in his lodgings and spent the next several weeks writing.
That was pretty egoless for an obnoxious guy.
Oh, I think so. I mean, Adams was the voice of the Revolution, and as Benjamin Rush famously said, and Jefferson was the pen of the Revolution. But Adams was nothing, although his ego was fairly massive, he was a very savvy politician. And he knew that it needed somebody with Jefferson's felicity of writing and with the power of Virginia behind it to actually sell it to the Congress, because Adams knew he would be the one who would ultimately be doing the selling on this.
And so what happened then?
You have to remember that Jefferson, like so many of the delegates, comes up to the Congress without a lot of books. Without a lot of reference materials. And so Jefferson writes this remarkable document pretty much from his own head, without doing a lot of consulting of reference materials. But remember, too, that Jefferson, like all the delegates to the Congress, were very much men of the Enlightenment. They were steeped in the work of John Locke, David Hume, Francis Hutcheson, Henry Bolingbroke, and, of course, Cicero. And many of the phrases that we've come to associate with the Declaration of Independence, particularly this idea of God-given rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, are not original to Jefferson. They actually appear in earlier documents, like John Locke and George Mason. Mason was a colleague of Jefferson's who had actually written a Declaration of Rights for Virginia prior to the Declaration, in which he stated, quote, all men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent natural rights, among which are the enjoyment of life and liberty. So Jefferson is working from a considerable amount of knowledge that was part of the gray matter of the men who made the Revolution happen. So he writes this document, which of course has to go through an editing process. We like to celebrate, much to John Adams' chagrin, I might add, July 4th is Independence Day, but independence was actually debated and declared by the Congress on the 2nd of July. That's the date we actually became independent of Great Britain. It took two marathon days of argument for Congress to agree on the final form of the Declaration. At the end of the day, over 80 changes were made in it. Some of them were minor, simple word changes, but others were cut very, very deep into Jefferson's draft. Jefferson was somewhat embittered by these changes, and he never forgot them. And later, when it came time for him to work on his memoirs and his autobiographical notes, he took the time to actually set in opposition his original draft of the Declaration with what was actually agreed upon by Congress and later published to the states in general. And I think it'll be instructive as we go through the Declaration of Independence to talk about some of those differences.
Well, why don't we start reading the Declaration of Independence? We're talking with Kirk Ellis about this fine document. And as we come to some of these words and concepts and some of these changes, too, which probably most of our listeners, I certainly didn't know about them, we'll talk about those. Would you like to start?
I'd be honored. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And Jefferson's being a very good writer here. He's essentially declaring the reason for this document. And he put it very well in his memoirs. He said it was not his objective to be original. It was, quote, only to place before mankind the common sense of the subject, neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing. It was intended to be an expression of the American mind, and to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. And he does that in what is perhaps the most famous paragraph of this document, which I'd like you to read.
Okay. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed."
And that right there is the key to the argument, that government derives from the will of the people, which became Jefferson's touchstone. And it was the center point of all the arguments he would later have with John Adams over the form of government this country would take that resulted in the Constitution written at that convention in 1789, largely by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. But let's talk about this famous paragraph, because much as we like to think of Jefferson as the sole author of the Declaration, that's not the case. Like so many writers, he felt a need to show the document to some of his colleagues. And for those of us who do that on a regular basis, we know that that way madness lies, because the changes start and they never stop coming.
You write by committee and it's never as good.
You do. In Jefferson's initial draft, he said certain truths were sacred and undeniable. He shows this to Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. And it is Franklin who says, "Do you not think perhaps, Mr. Jefferson, that two words, or maybe one word, is better than three?" And that is how self-evident comes about. That's one of the first changes that's made, but by far not the last. It's also important to look at this word happiness. This is a word that has a very, very different meaning in the 18th century than it does today. We like to think of happiness as, I'm happy, I have everything I want. And there are more things I want, and I know I can get them. That's not the sense of happiness in the 18th century. It's hard to exactly define what that word meant at that time, but the closest we can come is to say that happiness meant the ability of an individual to live an independent life, to have the means to live. Nothing more than that. That's what's being suggested here by the Declaration of Independence.
So basically food, shelter, clothing.
That's correct.
That's what happiness meant.
Exactly right. Yeah, nothing more than that. Okay, it has none of those Oprah-like connotations that it does today. So Jefferson goes on in this document, and this is all very much what he wrote, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed." Remember, the founders were being cautious here. They were more than aware that a third of the population was loyal to the British crown, and we think perhaps even more than that today. So he was saying, look, this is not a precipitous decision. We have debated and we have considered the implications of what is being done here, and we feel that it is better now to make this break than continue to suffer these indignities that will only get worse. Have they not gotten worse in your community? So it is... He is talking to the American people and letting them know that this group of people who have been sent by the individual colonies, they're still colonies, they're not yet states, to represent them, is not doing something that will lead to a negative end. Okay. He then goes on and says, "But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former system of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states." Notice Jefferson the writer. He's talking about despotism. He's talking about tyranny. He's talking about usurpation of rights. He is very clearly stating that the situation with the king has become intolerable, that it is not what we would now call a constitutional monarchy with the king in parliament. The king and his minions, his ministers, are dictating to America what they should do, and this cannot be allowed to happen. Having made this argument, this works very much like a traditionally written essay. There is a sort of opening explanation of what the argument will be, making the argument, and then drawing a conclusion from it. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And I think it would be great for you and I to sort of alternate these causes. And I think what may surprise some of your listeners is the fact that a lot of the causes and a lot of the language here are very specific to what was happening at the time. And we must always remember that with the founding documents, there is a context for them, and they must be considered in their historical period to have that sort of power.
So I will read the first one, and you and I can go back and forth, stopping where necessary if we need to. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good.
He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them.
He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right of inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records, for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. That requires some explanation. What the Crown was doing at this point was it was dissolving the local legislatures and moving them to places where only its representatives could attend, therefore depriving the people of their right to representation, essentially repeating the same thing in the territory of America that was happening within the halls of British Parliament.
If I may just stop the declaration for a moment, why were they doing this? What was in it for Britain?
Well, you have to remember that Britain had fought a very punishing and expensive war with France. And one of the ways that they were looking to make up their losses was to tax the American colonies unduly, to establish monopolies of things like tea and other goods and glass for windows, lead, so that they could make up. Look, I think this would be familiar to listeners today. You fight a war and you have to pay for it somehow.
Right.
The British chose to actually tax America more than it did some of its other colonies. When resistance took place, then they stepped up the military occupation of places like Boston. They dissolved the legislature in Virginia and actually moved it to a ship that was offshore, where only royal ministers could attend. And it was things like that. It was a misguided attempt to suppress a native movement.
Let's go on. We're reading the Declaration of Independence with Kirk Ellis. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time after such disillusions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
And that's sort of forgotten in the discussions of the underlying causes of the revolution. One of the things that was happening is that immigration to the Americas was being restricted because there was a fear that it would simply lead to a larger population of insurrectionists. A year before this, at the Battle of Bunker Hill, the American rebels were actually referred to by the British government as terrorists. That was the word that was used.
This never goes away.
It does not. It just seems the nature of the imperial mind or the colonial mind.
I have to also say, our founding fathers wanted more immigration.
That is what is being implied very clearly in Jefferson's statement here.
Very interesting.
Now, the original text here reads, and it's slightly different. This is one of the small changes. He has suffered the administration of justice totally to cease in some of these states, refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. And that was actually changed to, he has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. Again, see, they eliminated the reference to states there. You know, we want to be independent, but there are still some of us who don't wish to offend.
It's interesting that you're making a declaration of independence from a monarchy, but you don't wish to offend.
Well, we can be polite about it.
Okay. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries.
That was one of the intolerable acts that was passed in Boston shortly before this, which was that all judges in the colonies would be appointed by the British Crown, that the local administration would have no say on them whatsoever. And it got worse than that. Any British soldier, for instance, accused of a crime would be sent back to Britain for trial, would not be tried. You know? An amazing circumstance when you consider the fact that John Adams actually successfully argued for the innocence of the soldiers in the so-called Boston Massacre. He has erected a multitude of new officers and sent hither swarms of new officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures.
He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. And I should say these three paragraphs that we have read really refer to the increase of troops then occupying Boston and New England. And the idea of swarms of new officers, standing armies, this would have been hot-button issues for the people who were hearing the Declaration proclaimed, because many of them may have found themselves driven out of their own homes by British soldiers who were quartered in their establishments.
He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. By the way, Jefferson's original word there was states. For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever, no translation needed.
Right. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us.
He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation.
Now Jefferson's going really over the top there for a reason. Congress actually adds scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages just to make the point. They're obviously referring to the group of mercenaries who are commonly known as Hessians, okay, who came from Saxony. They were paid mercenaries, bought by the English to fight the English cause in America. Many of them had no idea what the revolution was even about, but they were simply doing what they were paid for. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. This is the practice of impressment, where American sailors on the high seas could be forcibly held by the British and made to serve in the British Army against their fellow Americans.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
We cannot, when we hear words like this, and those of us who live in Santa Fe know, of course, the word savages was etched out of our monument down on the plaza, But this is common terminology for documents of this sort in the 18th century. And remember again that many of the people who were serving in Congress remember very vividly the French and Indian War, where a great deal of atrocity was committed on both sides. Washington himself was a participant and a witness to those atrocities when he was serving under General Braddock in the British Army.
And if you've just tuned in, we're reading the Declaration of Independence with Kirk Ellis.
At this point in the published declaration, the list of grievances ends. But that is not, in fact, where Jefferson's document ended. And this is where one of the largest cuts in his original text was made. And I will read you what he actually wrote. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain. Determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold, he has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this execrable commerce. And that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished dye, he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them by murdering the people on whom he also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of others. Now, this is an amazing passage.
Indeed.
Okay. Jefferson is essentially doing two things here. He is throwing the entire weight of slavery on the man he calls the Christian King of Great Britain. He is saying that the British government, the British crown, is enslaving people. It is taking them to a place they don't want to be. It's depriving them of rights. And it is them then demanding that they go out and kill people who are in rebellion to fight for rights that they believe are theirs by nature.
And of course, the King of England wasn't what you might call solely responsible for the perpetuation of slavery.
Well, no, we might actually call that passing the buck. Jefferson is laying it on pretty thick here in terms of the crimes of the King of Great Britain to make his point for the general populace. But it has to be noted that slavery was not only practiced by the British, nor was it unique to British colonization. We know it existed in Spain. We know, for that matter, existed among various tribes in Africa before it was exported to the New World. It's a bit of a stretch, and that may have been one of the reasons for its omission. It's an extraordinary piece. However, it incites one of the largest debates in Congress in those 2 days from July 2nd to July the 4th. It is ultimately struck because, as Franklin famously said, the issue that was before the Congress at that time was not emancipation, but independence. This is the first example of the temporizing that the American government will do on the issue of slavery. It gets thrown from one generation to the next until it finally erupts, of course, in the Civil War. But it is clearly on the minds of those people in Congress. But the argument was made at the time that had this been allowed in, that the Southern delegates would probably have walked out of the convention. Because this is, of course, what happens in 1861, the beginning of the secessionist movement that leads to the Civil War. So as much as this was in Jefferson's mind and in Jefferson's heart, it was ultimately cut. But it says a lot about Jefferson that he left it in when he took the time to actually bring this out. Jefferson has a very complex relation with slavery, as you know.
Right.
He has a mistress who's a slave who he does not free in his will, although he frees other slaves on the plantation. And yet, all of the founders, with the exception of John Adams, at one time or another owned slaves. Adams is really the only one. We can't call him an abolitionist, really. It was just part of that New England Puritan upbringing that he had. Abigail later famously says, in the most dire times of Boston, you know, could this trial not be punishment for the sin of slavery? So they were among the more forward thinking. But here it is, right here, struck from the Declaration of Independence. It then goes on in the published document, in every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injuries. Again, referring to King George, and Jefferson hated the British crown with a passion. Okay, this later leads him to support all of the worst ravages of the French Revolution. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Again, that's where the published document ends. Jefferson actually says, a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a people who mean to be free. Future ages will scarcely believe that the hardiness of one man adventured within the short compass of 12 years only, which was the reign of King George at that point, to lay a foundation so broad and so undisguised for tyranny over a people fostered and fixed in principles of freedom. It's important to note Jefferson here uses the word posterity. I think if you did a Google search of the documents of the founding generation, the word posterity would pop up more than any. That's because they knew they were writing for history. They knew the generations would be looking back on their actions, and so they were very, very responsible in what they said and what they did. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, as well as to the ties of our common kindred, to disavow these usurpations, which were likely to interrupt our connection and correspondence. This is the beginning of a long passage in Jefferson's original document that, along with the slavery issue, causes a tremendous debate. And for Jefferson, even more than the slavery clause, is the great cut that is made from this. For Jefferson, the key argument declaration was that the people of Great Britain themselves had a chance to essentially rise up and say, no, this is wrong. Okay, these are our brothers. The American Revolution has often been portrayed, and it's one of the reasons we made John Adams, as this conflict between full-blooded Americans and British. You know, Americans who spoke with full-blown Boston and Virginia accents, and British people who spoke as though they'd walked off the set of Masterpiece Theater episodes. But that's not the case. These were British Americans who were making a fundamental break with everything that they knew. They were taking a leap into the dark. And that was what Jefferson wanted to make very, very clear, not only to the listeners in America, but to those people who would read this declaration when it was published in Great Britain. So here is how this passage originally reads. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here, no one of which could warrant so strange a pretension, that these were effected at the expense of our own blood and treasure, unassisted by the wealth or strength of Great Britain. That in constituting indeed our several forms of government, we had adopted one common king, thereby laying a foundation for perpetual league and amity with them. But that submission to their parliament was no part of our constitution, nor ever an idea, if history may be credited. And we appeal to their native justice and magnanimity, as well as to the ties of our common kindred, to avow these usurpations which were likely to interrupt our connection and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. And when occasions have been given them, by the regular course of their laws, of removing from their councils the disturbers of our harmony, they have, by their free election, reestablished them in power. At this very time, too, they are permitting their chief magistrate to send over not only soldiers of our common blood, but Scotch and foreign mercenaries to invade and destroy us. These facts have given the last stab to agonizing affection, and manly spirit bids us to renounce forever these unfeeling brethren. We must endeavor to forget our former love for them and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace friends. We might have been a free and great people together, but a communication of grandeur and freedom, it seems, is below their dignity. Be it so, since they will have it. The road to happiness and glory is open to us too. We will tread it apart from them and acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our eternal separation. Those are strong words.
Yeah.
Jefferson is really moved by the spirit of what he's writing here to essentially say, we renounce everything that's come before this, that is no longer a part of identity as a people. But all of this gets struck. And that long passage that I just read gets reduced to, they too have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace friends. A very different meaning than what Jefferson is talking about here. Again, let us declare independence, but let us be polite about it.
Right.
And other changes are made in this final declaration, where finally the words of Richard Henry Lee's original resolution of Congress are incorporated into the document, and it is made very clear that this is a break. And so if you would read what's published, we'll talk about what happens with Jefferson's text.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all the allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all these other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Now, those are incredibly stirring words, and whenever they were read out, it took months for the declaration to be read out. It wasn't read out in Georgia, I believe, until almost August. It was always something that got people's blood boiling. But the omissions and changes in Jefferson's text, I think, are instructive about the way he thought and the way the Congress thought as a whole. In his original text, he wrote this: "We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America and General Congress assembled, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these states, reject and renounce all allegiance and subjection to the kings of Great Britain and all other who may hereafter claim by, through, or under them. We utterly dissolve all political connection which may heretofore have subsisted between us and the people or parliament of Great Britain. And finally, we do assert and declare these colonies to be free and independent states, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortune, and our sacred honor." Two very important things that are missing from his from his end of the declaration and what Congress adds. At the beginning, Congress adds, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions. And at the very end, they add, and for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. They both make those claims to a higher power.
Now, there's not a whole lot of higher power in this document, but there is some, and let's talk about that.
It is a general misconception, okay, that the founding documents of this country, both the Declaration and the Constitution, are based on a Christian ethic. The strongest word that is used is the word creator. That is the highest power that is invoked here. And that is very typical of the deistic thought of the time, whether we're talking about Washington or Jefferson or Franklin or many of the others. There was this belief in providence, that sort of watchmaker, you know, who sets the world in motion, but it is up to men to make their fortunes and futures. And I think it's impossible to read the Declaration without getting that sense from Jefferson's original text, that it is we, you know, the men of America, and remember, it was the men of America to whom this was pitched,
right,
that we have this chance to establish a new form of government. We don't know what that form of government is, and in fact, it's going to take us over a decade to actually figure it out, and even then, we're still not going to agree, and you know, 100 years later, there's going to be a war, and then we'll get back together again. I mean, so there's all of this that's going on, but they are very clearly stating that this is going to be a man-made effort, okay, because These are rights that we hold by virtue of being men.
And that's the Enlightenment idea.
It is completely, these documents are very much products of Enlightenment thinking. And as I've said many times before in talking about this period in our history and about John Adams, we were incredibly lucky in the timing of this, that these men, and many of them were lawyers, they were what we would now call part of the political elite, there's no mistaking that. They were among the richest men in their colonies, they were among the most well-educated, they were among the ones with the broadest experience. And so they came together with all of these thoughts that they had derived from their study of ancient Greece, ancient Rome, from the reading of John Locke, and they put them together into this indelible piece of American history that was our first attempt to understand ourselves and why we were doing what we were doing.
So there had been, during the 18th century, moments of greater religiosity and greater secularism, and so we happened to hit a kind of secularist moment.
Yes.
Which founded our country.
That is correct. That is correct. And Adams and Jefferson both lived long enough, you know, to the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, that they see many of these movements spring up and subside, and spring up and subside, and spring up and subside, and they're coming out of an era. They're coming out of an era of great charismatic preachers like Cotton Mather, you know, who was an acquaintance of many of them, especially Benjamin Franklin. But they are very firmly pitching this, I think, and I should always, you know, sort of preface this, that this is a personal opinion. They are very much pitching this as a document written by men for other men, not a divinely inspired document that they are dictating to other people.
There is this phrase in the very first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. the laws of nature and of nature's God. How do you understand that?
I think I understand that in the same way I understand providence. You know, that the natural world is something that, you know, that encompasses all understanding and is the work of something other than us mere mortals. But it is because that we are part of that natural world that we are endowed with these same rights, and that any attempt to restrict these rights, and remember, the rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In other documents, this is referred to as life, liberty, and property. Okay? Property is happiness as well.
You said at the beginning of the program, the pursuit of happiness understood in 18th century terms means sort of food, shelter, and clothing. I mean, that kind of basic material happiness.
And these were the things that were being more and more restricted as we move from 1775 into those amazing days of June and July of 1776.
The idea that all men are created equal and that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, that is also something that I think is a perpetual argument that people, I mean, are all people equal? Are they created equal? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, what did it mean to the founders? Because remember, too, if all men are created equal, then why did slaves only count for 3/5 of a person when it came time to actually write the Constitution? So were all men created equal? And does men mean women? Does it mean savages, quote unquote? Does it mean slaves? I mean, we continue to debate what this means.
But even among, let's say, white males, the poorest and the richest, by this way of thinking, have the exact same rights to trial by jury, to whatever.
Yes, and I think that was something that was very true in Jefferson's mind, and in the imagined world of democracy that he created for himself. There's a famous there's a famous anecdote which David McCullough recounts in his book on Adams about Adams and Jefferson touring a foundling home in Paris. And Jefferson looks at these babies, you know, in their cribs, and he says, isn't this a marvelous example of what we're talking about here, that every single one of these children, okay, is born to the same rights? And Adams thinks about it for a second, and he says, well, they may be born to the same rights, but they're not going to have the same opportunities. And I think that's the fundamental debate between Jefferson and Adams. Rights versus opportunities, rights versus responsibilities. A government that is very loosely administrated, and a government that has a much stronger administration. because when it comes time to write the Constitution, so many of those people, Hamilton, Madison, many of the others, they have a terrible experience of the Articles of Confederation, which is a very loose affiliation of the states with no central authority. The Revolution starts to be fought after this in a very, very real way. And throughout it, Congress keeps deferring to Washington. We can't actually raise these men for you. We can't actually raise these arms. We can't dictate to the states to help you out. You've just got to sort of fend for yourself. Well, this is clearly not a system that's going to work. And that leads to a discussion of how are we going to sort out the Articles of Confederation? And it results in a Constitution that is very much in the mold that John Adams thought our government should be, although neither he nor Jefferson is present for any of those debates. They read them in foreign countries, as a matter of fact, one in Paris and one in England. This idea that there must be a supreme executive, there must be two houses of Congress, and there must be an independent legislature. And we go back and forth about the Constitution the same way we do about the Declaration. But I think that, again, this is an instructive process, reading it word for word and looking at its structure. Because when you go to the Constitution, look at Articles 1, 2, and 3, which are that about the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. The legislative branch is put first, and it gets the largest amount of ink. So very clearly, the founders thought there needed to be a stronger rather than a weaker hand on the till.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis about the Declaration of Independence. I mean, reading through this, and we've only got a couple of minutes left, but it makes it so clear that generation after generation after generation, we fight the same battles and have the same arguments. I mean, yes. You know, the Southerners would have walked out if the slavery clause had been in. Well, in the middle of the 20th century, the Southern Democrats abandoned their party for almost the same reasons.
Right. No, I mean, the thing about the study of history is that in all its complexity, you find that the more things change, the more they stay the same. The only thing that differs is the language and how great it is to sort of go through this and hopefully give people a sense of how eloquent the language was then and how moving it was. I just don't think these kinds of documents would work as tweets or emails with emoticons today. And we have lost so much in our political discourse because we don't want to address complexities. We don't want to lay things out in the way that Jefferson lays out these grievances in this document. But if only people would take time, I think there would be more room for forward momentum in our country and in our political thought.
Kirk Ellis is the writer and producer of the John Adams series, which once again is in its marathon right now on HBO. You can also get it on Netflix or at your video store. He is the chairman of the Santa Fe Arts Commission. He is an expert on our founding fathers, and we have just read and talked about the Declaration of Independence. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a real pleasure. I love talking about history and about this period in particular. Thank you.
Let's talk about the Constitution sometime.
I would love to. I welcome that.
Excellent. Happy 4th of July.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz. Happy 4th of July, ladies and gentlemen.